When you ask Google for images of charismatic megafauna, you're going to get photos of elephants, tigers, pandas, and koalas. Koalas with their rounded faces, their tufted ears, and the adorable way their little joeys view the world from the safety of their mama's pouches. Conservationists know charismatic animals have a good chance at making humans care enough to preserve their habitats. But for koalas in the modern world, that's a mixed blessing. They're at risk of straight-up extinction in some places and dying in others because there are more of them than the ecosystem can support. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Danielle Claude is a biologist and natural history author who lives in the Adelaide Hills in South Australia, a place where there may be as many as 150,000 koalas who can sometimes be spotted in trees or sipping from people's backyard pools. But Claude is worried that in traditional koala regions in the eastern parts of the country, populations have plummeted, and some advocates warn they are in danger of being wiped out altogether. Claude set out to learn why, and luckily for us, she has shared her findings in a book called Koala, A Natural History and an Uncertain Future. Danielle, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
Since you're speaking mostly to an American audience here, I hope that you'll forgive me asking some things that any self-respecting five-year-old can answer where you live. For one thing, koalas live only in Australia, but they don't live all over Australia. I'm not sure every American knows that.
Yeah, they're very carefully restricted to the forested areas of Australia, and a great deal of Australia in the last 100,000 years has only been, you know, is desert, and it's only the east coast and south coast that is really heavily forested, and particularly with the eucalypt forests that the koalas are dependent on.
How have their populations changed over time in the areas where they do live so that there are fewer than there used to be right in the eastern parts of the country and more in the south?
Yeah, it's really hard to know because it's very hard to count koalas. They're quite hard to see. They're very widely dispersed through the forest, so they don't, you know, hang about in packs or in herds. They live individually in the trees. So we're never really sure how many there were or indeed how many there are now. But they're definitely fewer than there would have been. The forests are significantly reduced in the last 200 years since European colonization. So that means there's just fewer places for koalas to live.
It seems as if there's nothing quite like them. What are their closest living relatives?
They are a very distinctive animal, aren't they? Their closest living relative is actually a wombat, which is an animal that lives in burrows underground, so you really couldn't get much more different. But they're both stocky little animals, they're both tailless, and they do have some physiological characteristics, obviously, that we can see makes them related. But that's the only relative it has that's living. It did have more relatives in the relatively recent past. It's related to some of Australia's biggest megafauna. So Australia didn't have mammoths or, you know, saber-toothed tigers or any of those classic Ice Age animals. We had giant marsupials, and one of which was the giant Diprotodon, which was a 2 or 3 ton, I guess the closest thing you might think is a giant wombat.
There was possibly also something like a giant koala? Would it have looked like a koala today, only much bigger?
Yes, there were other koalas. So the living koala today is the last of its family. But in the past, there have been several other sorts of koalas over time in variable places and spread across a bigger area because the inland used to be covered in quite wet forests in places, in fact. So the koalas were distributed in swampy forests. And those prehistoric koalas range from small, possibly possum-like animals to a giant koala, which was 3 times the size of the current koala. So a little bit more like a small bear, if you like.
They're like humans in that way, that they're the last of their family, right? Do we know why the species of koala we have around today is the one that survived?
Well, we don't know for certain, but we suspect that it's probably because the earlier koalas lived on different trees. So they probably browsed the older forests before the eucalypts became dominant. Now, the eucalypts are a quite tricky tree to eat because they have a high toxin load. So they have a lot of tannins and other toxins that make them, they make animals feel ill when they eat them. And we think that possibly the modern koala managed to find a way to consume those eucalypts, and that's what's made it so successful in the modern era.
The koalas that exist today might have somewhat different faces depending on where they live. What is Bergman's rule, and how might that play into the difference?
Yeah, well, they have different pelts. Their fur is slightly different, and that does seem to relate to the north-south gradient, which is what Bergman's rule refers to. So, the colder the climate, the bigger the animal tends to be of the same species. And when you move into the warmer tropical area, they get smaller. So, the northern Queensland koalas for us are quite small, and they've got thinner pelts, so their fur is not as thick. Whereas the ones down south are quite a bit bigger and a lot fluffier.
Any reason to think koalas ever did have tails way back in evolutionary history?
Look, we assume, I mean, most people would assume that they didn't, but it's quite likely that they did. But unfortunately, the fossil record for koalas is quite poor, like most of the fossil record in Australia. So we'll just have to wait until somebody actually finds a complete koala skeleton rather than just the fragments which we have at the moment, which is mostly just teeth and jaws. So one day perhaps they'll find a full koala skeleton and we'll be able to answer that question.
I spent a lot of time on Google while reading your book, and one of the things I had to look up was koalas' really remarkable hands. What's so special about them?
They are quite amazing things. Koalas have a couple of characteristics quite characteristic of Australian marsupials. So they have one of their fingers, well, actually their toes, it's on their feet, is actually joined together. So they've got a syndactylous toe. So they've got two claws coming out of one toe. They've also got thumbs, which makes them quite, related. It makes us think of how our hands work. But they have two thumbs. So on their hands, they have two thumbs and three fingers, giving them sort of like a Vulcan-like hand. And on their feet, they have this joined toe and a big blunt thumb without a claw. So they're quite strange looking feet.
What might the benefits be of two thumbs?
Well, I guess they have to use their hands and their feet for gripping onto trees and for climbing. So just like us, they need a very a hand that's good for gripping things. They also use them for grabbing leaves, and their fingers seem to be quite sensitive. They have bare skin on their hands, and they actually have fingerprints just the same as we do, and those fingerprints are individually identifiable. And they look very similar to ours. And so they're one of the few animals other than primates that have fingerprints.
You write about seeing a koala leap from one branch to another. I had no idea they could sort of jump that way.
Yes, they're actually quite agile, but people assume that they're slow and a bit dopey because we don't see them moving very much. Most of the time they spend asleep up in their trees, and in particular during the daytime. So they're more active at night. But when they do move around, they're very agile and quite acrobatic. But they're certainly not animals that generally feel in a hurry to get anywhere. So they don't have any reason to rush off or move quickly. So they generally take their time.
What kind of muscle mass do koalas have compared with a similar sized animal that might live on the ground?
Well, like most climbing animals, they do need to be quite strong. Their arms and shoulders, in particular, are extremely powerful because they need to use their shoulder muscles to lift themselves up the trees. And I think that's probably the biggest energetic cost for koalas is that movement up and down trees. So they like to be very careful about which tree they choose to go up, because once they get up there, they're going to want to stay put. We have to remember that a lot of Australian forests are extremely tall. So the eucalypts are the tallest hardwood in the world, includes one of the tallest hardwoods, and that tree, the mountain ash, which is the tallest, is tall, can be taller than redwoods. So they're extremely tall forests that they can be exploiting. So they need to be really, really good climbers for that. And they also have to have really good jaw muscles, obviously, for chewing all those tough eucalypt leaves.
I hadn't realized until I picked up your book that eucalyptus is as toxic as it is, right? We put it in cough drops and things like that, so I guess I had assumed that it wasn't so harmful. What do we know about why koalas are able to digest this food that would kill a lot of other creatures?
Yes, well, the part of the reason with I mean, eucalypts have two things. They're very fibrous, they're very tough leaves, so they have a lot of lignin and cellulose in them. And so, like other herbal grass, it has lots of cellulose as well. So, those sorts of plant material is very hard for mammals to digest. So, mammals need very special stomachs to do that, and they also need bacteria to assist them to break down cellulose. They can't, we, n no, mammals can't do that on their own, they have to have bacteria to do it. So, koalas similarly have very complex digestive systems to do that. But the toxins are a different matter, and they're usually dealt with by the liver. So, koalas have a supercharged liver. They have a large, complex liver. And we know from genetic studies that it has a double dose of the genes that remove the toxins. So that's how they cope with their toxic diet.
They have survived as Australia's climate has changed, as you described, from being much wetter than it is today to quite arid in a lot of places. What makes koalas suited to surviving drought conditions?
Yes, it's interesting because we always think of koalas as being particularly drought adapted, I guess, because they live in the eucalypts and because their name, koala, is said to be an indigenous word for not drinking water. There's a common conception that koalas don't need to drink water. In actual fact, they do need to drink water. They just get most of their water from the leaves of the trees that they eat and from, rain on the leaves. But in hot weather, they certainly come down and drink water, and people commonly see them drinking in their backyard. They come down and drink out of a bucket or any water that's lying around. And famously, we see pictures during bushfires of koalas accepting water from firefighters and things like that. So they do need to drink water. But nonetheless, there's no doubt that they are adapted to cope with less water. They're adapted to cope with Australia's changing climate, and they also have that boom and bust pattern of a lot of animals to make sure that they can breed quickly in the wet years and exploit the new conditions, and then they tend to disappear in dry years.
So there's something about their bodies that senses how plentiful resources are when it comes to reproduction.
Yes, there seems to be. There's plenty of Australian animals that do that. Kangaroos are very, very much like that. They're very tied to water supply. A lot of our birds are like that. They're less inclined to follow seasonal patterns of breeding, and more inclined to follow longer term climate changes because Australia tends to have an oscillating climate between, 10 or 15 years of drier conditions and then 10 or 15 years of wetter conditions.
Does that perhaps prepare Australian wildlife a little better than wildlife elsewhere in the world for the kind of long-term climate change we're looking at today?
Well, certainly some of them. We do have some wildlife that is not so capable of dealing with that. The wildlife that is restricted to the wet tropics, for example, or the alpine forests. Animals like a koala, which occupy that middle ground, if you like, and they exploit a fairly big habitat like the eucalypt forests, they're certainly in a better position for sure.
All right, Danielle, let's talk about how koalas make more koalas. That is the sound of a koala looking for love.
It's a very distinctive noise, and it's very hard to describe.
It sounds like bullfrogs to me.
Yes, there's lots of different descriptions. People will describe it as being sounding like a manic donkey or a car backfiring or a tractor. It's certainly not the most appealing noise in the world, but it's a noise that travels long distances through the forest. And the koalas have those big fluffy radar ears to listen for that sound, so they can hear each other across long distances.
Because they don't necessarily live near one another, at least males and females.
Yeah, they definitely spread out around the forest. So in under most conditions, you only find one koala on its own, and they can be very, very widely dispersed. So one koala really needs a forest the size of an average sports field to live on. So that you don't see them in large numbers as a rule.
How much competition is there for mates?
The males compete with each other quite a lot, and there's certainly they will fight with each other if they find, if they've found a female. And so the battles between them can be quite dramatic. But the koalas do, the females do seem to be quite particular, and they tend to mate, they often actually mate with the same male. So they do seem to have very particular preferences for their mating choice. The males are less particular. They seem to be keen to mate with whoever they can get hold of, and that does result in some very noisy battles in the springtime in the forests. The males do that bellow, but the females squeal and scream very loudly at the males to go away if they're not interested. So that's certainly a common noise to hear in the forest in Australia, which can be quite disturbing to visitors.
There are some sort of legends, or maybe they're jokes about drop bears. Will you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, the drop bear stories, that the idea that koalas are a dangerous animal and that they'll attack you by jumping out of the trees is, people find that a really funny story because, of course, koalas are generally fairly amiable animals. They're certainly not the most aggressive and or dangerous of Australian animals by a long shot. But it does seem to be a relatively recent story that's popped up. And I think Paul Hogan, the famous Australian comedian, has a lot to answer for in perpetuating that and spreading it around the world.
All right, we have to talk here about koala reproductive anatomy. Female koalas have two vaginas and two uteruses, but only give birth to one baby at a time, right?
Yes, they can have twins. So occasionally they will have twins, but they generally only have one. The interesting their biology, their reproductive biology is a characteristic of marsupials. So all marsupials have that two-pronged structure.
So they're not, pardon me for getting a little graphic here, they're not set up for a threesome. The males are adapted to the females' bodies.
No, well, that's the thing, is that koalas' penises are two-pronged, so they're perfectly adapted for the female koala.
So we do have some marsupials in the US, and opossums come to mind, which here in Texas we call possums. I know that's not technically correct. Australia, though, feels like the global capital of the marsupial. What makes these animals different from placental mammals?
Well, I mean, their breeding system is obviously the most distinctive thing. They give birth to tiny young, so they effectively don't have a pregnancy in the way that the mammals like us have pregnancies. So they give birth to their young much, much younger, when they're about the size of a jelly bean. And that tiny, tiny little young will crawl up through the mother's fur and into the pouch and effectively attach itself onto one of her teats or nipples, and stay there until it's much the same size as an infant, or the state of development that we would give birth to children at. So they effectively have their pregnancy externally in a pouch, if that makes sense, which I personally think is a really good system. I think it'd be great to have. And they can also hop back in, and so we know that they stay in the pouch, they hop in and out of the pouch for a long time. Some animals, like obviously kangaroos, keep their young in their pouch for quite some time, and I often see them outside, in the paddocks, these quite large young trying to squeeze themselves back into their mother's pouch with these great big long legs and tails hanging out. It's quite amusing to watch. Climbing animals, marsupials, often also carry their young on their back. So when the koala young get a bit bigger, they typically climb onto their mother's back, and they do that for quite a long time too. You sometimes see young animals that are quite large being carried by their poor mums up the trees.
You can think about that toddler who does not want to give up the stroller or the crib.
Yes. And you do see some conflict between the mother and the offspring when they get a bit big, and the mother's decided she's had enough and no, you can climb on your own.
What do koala mothers need to teach their joeys? And I guess baby animals in Australia, are they all called joeys or just the marsupials?
All the marsupial young are called joeys.
All right. So what do the koala joeys need to learn before they are separated from their mothers?
I guess the main issue is that they need to adapt to eating eucalypt. So the weaning process in koalas is, that's a very important phase, and that occurs through a slightly unpleasant kind of process, in that they need to obtain some of their mother's microbial gut biome. So the mother actually excretes a green pap. From the part of the digestive, it's not actually the normal digestive system, it's the part that has a rich microbial soup, and that the baby koala eats that, and that gives them the bacteria they need to digest the leaves that they eat. So before that, they have no interest in, they can't eat the eucalypt leaves. They might try and have a chew on them, but they don't eat them. And afterwards, after they get this dosing of bacteria, they can eat and digest the leaves. So I guess that's the main thing they need to learn from their mother. But the mother's also very important in telling them how to navigate through their environment, how to avoid predators, and how to keep safe. And young joeys are mischievous, curious little creatures and get themselves into trouble. So they need to be looked after by their mums, just like any offspring does.
What are the predators they most have to worry about?
Well, in today, it's commonly dogs, and cars are a major source of death and injury amongst koalas. So, but dogs are certainly a big problem for koalas, and they're great at risk when they're on the ground. And especially a mother with a koala or a joey on her back is particularly vulnerable to predation from ground dwellers. But in historically, other animals have been major predators. So up in the tropics, large pythons would be a risk. Also, the large eagles, so and powerful owls, the largest of the Australian owls is a known koala predator, and probably wedge-tailed eagles and other large eagles that we get here.
How does a mother koala let her joey know it's time to move out?
Yes, well, they often, I think it's probably food that is the main reason why they need to spread out and make their own way in the world, because the forests aren't big enough for two of them. And there's often a bit of a battle with the young joey when it needs to leave home. And sometimes they just wander off on their own, and sometimes the mother has to have a bit of a squeal and a shout at them, and give them a bit of a swipe and a bite, and then that usually makes them head off.
So if they need a certain amount of, square footage of acreage in order to have enough to eat, how do koalas map out their personal territory and avoid like taking up residence in somebody else's tree?
Well, they usually use scent as the way to navigate around between each other. So koalas tend to scent mark trees. So that could be through urination, but the males also have a scent gland on their chest that they rub on the trees. So the males are particularly clear on marking their territory, marking the area they're in, where they are. And koalas frequently sniff the base of the tree before they go up it. So they're inclined not to go up trees that other koalas have been in recently. And they're particularly careful about, if they're a non-breeding female, they'll avoid trees with males and those sorts of things.
When they do meet another koala, what does a greeting look like between two of these animals?
Well, that depends whether they're being friendly or not. If it's a not friendly encounter, it's very vocal and noisy and negative. But often they will bump noses if they're coming close, and they'll do that with humans as well, on rare occasions where they wish to interact. They actually come up and bump noses, which is extremely cute.
There are numerous accounts of koalas in some kind of distress, coming upon a human kind of reaching up for help like a small child would do. We see that and we assume they want us to pick them up, and of course it's tempting. What else might be going on? What might that koala be thinking?
Yeah, it's a tricky thing to respond to because it does elicit our immediate sort of maternal instincts to pick as we would pick up a small child. And indeed, this the same thing probably applies to young koalas. They probably are asking to be picked up, but they also that's also a motion to get up a tree as well. So sometimes koalas will try and climb you because you know that you're the tallest thing around, and it makes them feel safe to be up a tall thing. So you know it's a little bit difficult to know. So I think there's a little overlap between our different biological heritages, but also you know our ancestry is probably tree climbing as well. So we have that instinctive response to want to get up and sit up away from things and feel safe.
Let's go back, Danielle, to this belief that some people have that koalas might be a little dumb. As it happens, they have precisely the intelligence one needs to survive as a koala. But what do we know about their brains?
Well, we used to there used to be a long-standing view that koala brains were smaller than the skull, but so they sort of rattled around in the skull and only occupied about 60% of the skull cavity, which is a really unusual thing. That's not normally how anatomy works. Skulls usually fill the space available, and if they don't need a big space, you have a smaller skull. So that was a bit of a puzzle, but it seems that likely that the biologists were looking at preserved koalas, and of course, when they're pickled in alcohol or whatever, the brains tend to shrink. So now that we've looked at them in more recently, and particularly looked at with them with MRI, so looking at living brain tissue, we can see that the brain cavity actually fills the skull space pretty much the same as it does in every other mammal. And we've also looked at the sizes of the brain across different species, doing comparative analysis across all different mammals, marsupials and placental or eutherian mammals. And we can see that the koala brain's pretty average for its body size because brain size changes with body size, and koalas are smack in the middle there.
And people who study them have no doubt that individual koalas have individual personalities.
They're very distinctive personalities. I think the other reason that we have difficulty appreciating what koalas are doing is because they do things slowly and they don't do things very often. So they're not sort of hyperactive primates like us. They're very quiet, placid, and they're only active for half an hour or so a day. So, you know, we get a bit we find that difficult to perceive what's going on. It's just a t slower time scale. But yeah, their personalities are very distinct. Some are very friendly and affectionate, and some are definitely don't like other people or other koalas at all.
What kinds of sensory abilities are helpful to animals like them who are, when they are awake, it's mostly at night, and of course they live in a kind of vertical world rather than the horizontal one we inhabit?
Yeah, so they have, you know, their perceptual world is obviously very different to ours, and people have often thought that their vision is quite poor. I'm not sure that their vision is that poor, but it's certainly adapted to the world they live in. So they have quite close range vision. They use their hearing for long range communication and perception. And they also have unusual pupils in their eyes. So their pupils are instead, like most herbivores, like goats and sheep and things, have horizontal pupils that give them a wide range of vision, so they can scan the horizon and check for predators, and they can see a long way around themselves. Which koalas don't really need to do that; they need to see up and down. So it's not surprising their pupil is oriented up and down, which is a feature we see more commonly in predators like cats and things like that. And cats and predators are using it for close, careful vision on a particular object and also for perception of movement. And koalas are probably doing something similar in the trees, needing to see close up and quite precisely.
They get to a pretty good size. How do they avoid falling out of trees when they're sleeping?
That's often a mystery. If you see the way koalas sleep, they sleep in the most relaxed poses you could possibly imagine. It's absolutely fascinating to watch their poses. You'll see them lying on their backs with their legs in the air, draped across a tree, hanging off things, and yeah, they generally look really, really comfy in those trees. How they don't fall out, that's a good question. They do have they have a reinforced rump, so that's a feature that they inherited from the wombat family, if you like, because wombats also have this reinforced rump, although they don't use it for sitting on. But koalas seem to benefit from having that. They do, you know, obviously they have really big, strong claws, but they obviously have a very good sense of balance and a good proprioception, so a knowledge of where they are in the tree at all times. They're also very robust animals. So while koalas can be injured if they fall from trees, they are unexpectedly robust when they fall out of the tree.
Danielle, it took a long time for European scientists to start paying attention to koalas. How did it happen that Europeans in Australia failed to notice them when surely people native to Australia had always known about these animals?
It's really interesting when the first British settlement was established in what is now Sydney. There were no mention that they didn't mention koalas at all, and you know we tend to think that's very surprising. So there's been a lot of discussion about whether there were koalas in the forest at all, and lots of people say, well, they didn't have their eye in for koalas because koalas are up in the trees and they're hard to see, which is true. They are easy to miss. But the one thing that's not easy to miss is the koala bellow. I find it difficult to believe that if there were koalas in the trees, they didn't think, what on earth is that racket going on come spring? So I think it's more likely that there weren't koalas in that area in the early years of the colony. And we do find that koalas, they're more likely to be out along the rivers. So they should have been seen more sooner, I guess, along the rivers around Sydney. They were introduced to Europeans from Indigenous Australians who pointed them out. They pointed out what their droppings looked like, what their name was, and what they looked like. So all the early accounts came from that. But it's really interesting how little interest Europeans had in koalas, given how excited they were by kangaroos and by platypuses and things like that. You'd think they would have been more interested in koalas, but even when they had specimens, they didn't seem that keen on them at all.
What did it take for koalas to officially be deemed a protected species?
I think the interest in koalas really has come about when we thought we were going to lose them. So koalas were in danger of going extinct in the late 1800s, early 1900s, and that was through hunting for fur. So they actually were declared extinct in Victoria and South Australia, and they were great risk in New South Wales as well. And m millions of koalas were thought to have been seemed to have been hunted for fur, and the furs shipped out to the American and British fur markets. And it wasn't really until there were campaigns to stop them being hunted, and they were declared protected, but hunting continued really until the American president actually banned the importation of Australian furs and koala fur, and that dried up the trade. And after that, their numbers have partially recovered. But really, so their level of their protection or our concern over them has really stemmed from that period. And now we've got this very rapid decline in koalas. So it's not that koalas are so rare as to be declared endangered, but it's the speed of the decline that is worrying people. They're disappearing very quickly in areas that they have traditionally had strong populations in.
And it's not just ecosystem decline, it's also disease, right?
Yes, I suspect those two things are entwined together in some respects. So the East Coast populations of koalas are suffering from diseases, and it does seem that koalas have naturally tend to go through those epidemics of disease, particularly chlamydia and retrovirus. So they suffer from a AIDS-like retrovirus, which then makes the symptoms of chlamydia and other diseases worse for them. But the chlamydia is a really, really awful disease. That really, it's a terribly painful disease, which is quite horrible. So there is a lot of research going on to seeing if they can develop vaccines, which seem to have been successful. Of course, a medication for koalas is very difficult because they have that super-powered liver, which is so good at removing toxins. It's also extremely good at removing medicine. So koalas need massive doses of medicine to help them recover from those diseases. But I suspect that, koalas in the south have fewer diseases, but even those populations that do have the diseases seem to suffer from fewer symptoms. So suggest that if you've got a healthier habitat, they might be better, more resistant to those diseases.
You mentioned bushfires earlier. Talk a little bit about how climate change has really changed the ways koalas are threatened.
Yeah, bushfires are an integral part of the Australian ecosystem, and eucalypt forests are what part of the reason eucalypt forests are so successful here is because they can recover relatively, most of them can recover fairly well from bushfires. But over the last few decades, really, bushfires have become more frequent and also more severe. So that the pattern of fire is changing quite dramatically, probably due to the changing climate. And when we have fragmented forests, as we do now that there's big patches of clearing between forest habitats, we tend to have fires that can wipe out the entire population. So they're like the like we have instead of a massive continent of forest, as it were, we now have a little fragmented islands of forest. And if your island happens to be wiped out by a bushfire, then there's no possibility of koalas recovering and getting back into that forest when it recovers, and there's no food for any surviving animals.
Can they be successfully relocated to places that can still sustain them?
That's a very difficult task. They can, but it's a long, slow, and quite risky prospect, and not in the short term. So, because koalas are distinctly, they're adapted to the specific trees that they have grown up on. So, although there's 900 species of eucalypts, koalas are known to eat about 70 of those species. But any individual koala will only be able to eat between 4 and 10 species of eucalypt. So if you move them to a new forest, they're not going to have the right microbiome to feed on those eucalypts. So there's chances of them success being successful in surviving are much, much reduced. And that's another, one of the reasons why koalas were so hard to move overseas is because of that very specific diet that they require.
So, what you're talking about here really speaks to one of the challenges of conservation, right? We hear that an animal like the koala is endangered and we want to save it and people give money, but it's not enough to just give money to the animal and research around it. It's really the entire ecosystem that needs protection.
Absolutely. I mean, I know it's a boring thing to say, but it always comes down to habitat protection. And that's the thing that we tend to be really bad at. We like to try and save the animals, but we don't provide enough of the habitat. And koalas need a really big habitat and a very specific habitat. And I think on the East Coast in particular, we still have, that those th that the two state, New South Wales and Queensland, have one of the highest records of land clearance. Actually, I think they're pretty high world on a worldwide scale, and they also still have native logging going on in those East Coast forests. And logging changes the nature of the forest. So although you might think, well, there's still trees there, they're not taking all of them, the trees that recover are different from the trees that were there, and the trees that recover are not edible by koalas.
I think, Danielle, whenever we go to a part of the country or a part of the world that has different animals than where we live, it's very exciting, right? So I don't see deer every day here in Dallas, but if I go somewhere, I'm very excited. It might not be a big deal to someone who sees them a lot. What is the response by someone in the Adelaide Hills to seeing a koala in the wild?
The koalas are always a treat to see, I think, that we don't see them that often, unless you go looking for them in the areas where they live and you spend your time, peering up at the trees. But every now and again, you'll see them along the side, on the side of the road or walking through, a park area. And most people are always excited to see them. So they're certainly a special treat for Australians. And most Australians on the East Coast have never seen a koala in the wild because they're so rare there. So it's only in places where they're abundant in parts of Victoria and South Australia that you have that good fortune. But I did have a friend who said that she felt she was an Adelaide Hills local when she finally stopped thinking, "Oh, that's a funny looking dog," when she saw a koala. Actually realized that's a koala straight up.
Having lived in Australia, I wonder if you were surprised at how much there was to learn about this animal that is such a source of national pride when you undertook this project.
Absolutely. I actually, when I first decided to write this book on koalas, my background's in biology, and I thought, oh, a koala, that'll be a great, easy book to write. It'll be so simple. There's not much to them, but little did I know that they're unbelievably complicated animals, and there's so much to learn about them. So yes, I was really surprised.
What is the effect of koalas on tourism in Australia?
Koalas are really a major tourism attraction. We have lots of people who want to come and meet a koala in wildlife parks and have a close view of them, or travel to areas where they're easy to see, such as, Kangaroo Island in South Australia, or Magnetic Island in Queensland. They're certainly they're definitely a big ticket item for a lot of Australian visitors.
Do they do pretty well in captivity if they're well cared for?
If you've got a big forest that you can support them with, then they're pretty easy animals to keep, actually. You need to keep up a big variety of gum leaves, so they're quite labour intensive. You've got to carry in lots of different leaves for them, and they're very particular. What they ate yesterday, they might not choose to eat today. But they're very easy to look after, and they're very obliging in terms of being willing to sit on public view. They're not an animal that hides in a burrow or finds the darkest corner of their enclosure. They'll happily sit up in a tree on display and doze away for everybody to take their photo.
They were declared endangered just about a year ago. Can you talk a little bit about the difference between animals that are endangered by overpopulation and animals that are endangered by habitat loss and other problems?
So that's a really interesting designation because it's a state-based designation. Normally, we would just have one designation for a whole species, but that particular one applies to the populations in New South Wales, Queensland, and the Australian Capital Territory, and that's because those populations are declining very rapidly, and they are going. There's localized extinctions going on in those areas. In South Australia and Victoria, koalas are quite abundant in small areas. So those populations they're not technically endangered because there's a lot of them, but they're at risk of over-browsing their trees, and they have to be managed differently. So those koalas do have to be moved to new locations with the same type of forest. And the trouble is that we're running out of habitat for them because we've cut most of it down. So we need to have a different strategy for that. But in both cases, the problem is the same. It's both of them are caused by a lack of a suitable habitat.
Is there really strong support in Australia for ensuring that habitat that exists stays healthy and maybe is expanded over time?
I think, like most places, there's a really strong general support for conservation, and we're very keen on, declaring things national parks and looking, putting the names on them. But there's less support for actually doing the work that's needed to look after those parks. It's always implementation that's the problem. We need to do a lot of work in controlling weeds, managing populations, and controlling feral predators and things like that in order to keep those areas healthy and well maintained. And koalas are part of the problem, in a way. we've put the system out of balance, and in areas where we have too many koalas, we have to move them, and some people object to that. We have kangaroos that are very abundant in areas, and they actually cause a lot of environmental damage in some places because they prevent the regeneration of the forests, and so there's complex issues that are unpopular to discuss. But we really need to have those conversations and get things happening better.
Yeah, so it goes beyond just having a great affection for these animals and actually considering what they need.
I mean, we really need to be thinking about not just protecting the remaining forests, which is a hard thing to do, and stopping further clearance for agriculture and beef production or for forestry or whatever, but we also need to be looking at expanding the forest. We really need to get to a 30% natural vegetation coverage if we're going to protect the species we still have left.
Danielle Claude is a biologist and natural history author whose latest book is Koala, A Natural History and an Uncertain Future. Danielle, I've learned so much. Thank you very much for getting up early and spending this time with us.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
You can find us on Facebook and Instagram. You can subscribe to our podcast free where you get your podcast. Just search for KERA Think. Or you can check it all out at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.